I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, a senior opinion writer and columnist for the Boston Globe and co-host of the Politicon podcast, hashtag Sisters-in-Law. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the fourth week of March, and many of us were glued to the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. She seems to be on pace to make history and become the next Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. And it was a bruising and sometimes strange affair, to say the least. Republicans grilled her about some of her past cases, but also about a children's book, about critical race theory, about the definition of woman, and about how religious she is on a scale of 1 to 10. At the end of day two, Republican Senator Ben Sasse warned about what he called, quote, the jackassery we see around here of people mugging for the cameras. Before we talk about what we learned about the politics of 2022, what did we learn about Ketanji Brown Jackson and about the future of the court? To talk about that, let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. I'm your guest host and your center. I am joined by David Dayan on the left, executive editor at the American Prospect. Hi, David.
Hi.
And Sarah Isger on the right, staff writer at the Dispatch. She was the spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
So I do want to talk about what we learned about the nominee. I will start. One thing I will learn is a new definition for judicial temperament. I found it amazing that for in excess of 20 hours, Judge Jackson sat in that seat. She seemed largely unflappable, regardless of what was going on, what the questioning was, what sort of visual aids were being used, who was shouting at whom. She never raised her voice. She largely was unflinching. And at the times that she did flinch, I think it was pretty understandable why. But I learned a lot about her personal demeanor. I learned about her family story. Her parents were sitting there. I found it very moving when she talked about the time that she was really the first generation in her family that didn't grow up at a time of legalized segregation, and that this opportunity was not lost on her, given where she and her family came from. We saw her husband and children, her husband's impeccable taste in socks. But, you know, it was a real moment to allow her to be a person, a human. You know, we talk about the Supreme Court a lot in terms of what it does as a body, as an entity. But it is a body made up of 9 human beings. And I think it was an opportunity for America to see a little bit about what sort of a human being she is. Sarah, what did you learn about Judge Jackson during these hearings?
Well, a few things. One, undoubtedly, her experience in confirmation hearings in just the last few years paid off really well. As you said, she certainly passed every test. I don't know that she aced everyone. And it's always the goal of the White House and the nominee to showcase their humanity, right? If it's the old lobster in the restaurant, right? If you name the lobster, you're not going to cook the lobster. And so they did, I think, a very good job of forcing the senators to put a name, a history, a family with the lobster in the hopes that they wouldn't order lobster on the menu. However, I do think there were missed opportunities, some by Judge Jackson, the most frankly by the senators who were, as I think we all felt very much what Ben Sasse said, just showcasing a lot of jackassery across the spectrum. But you know, some of the questions that Judge Jackson got that were sort of the most difficult in some cases, the ones where I think even you acknowledged she flinched, not, of course, literally, but maybe verbally, maybe a little flippant, a little snide at a couple poignant moments. I think that was an opportunity for her to push back. So, for instance, when asked about sentencing in the child pornography cases, she should have pushed back and said, you know, who could set mandatory minimums for child pornography cases? You, Senator. That's a legislative job, not a judicial job. And when it came to what is the definition of a woman? Well, her job as a judge is to look at the statutory language around that. If she's looking at a case about Title VII or other gender-related protections in the law, and if you want to have a specific definition of woman in statute, Senator Blackburn, then that's your job, not mine. And I wanted to see her push back on the legislative branch and stop trying to make the judicial branch the legislative branch.
Yeah, I mean, I thought she did a little bit. She did remind people when she was very carefully describing how sentencing works that she's bound by the laws as set by Congress. But David, what did you learn about Judge Jackson?
I don't know that I learned anything about Judge Jackson because that's not what these hearings are designed for. I mean, full disclosure, I was not glued to these hearings, and because of the format and what they end up drawing out, that's one of the reasons. What I feel Americans need to learn, not just about Judge Jackson, but about their judges and the justices of the Supreme Court in general, is their philosophy of the law, and particularly the philosophy on areas where, at least in my view, the court has fallen down over the years. I'm not really sure what Judge Jackson's philosophy of justices. I'm not sure what Democrats' philosophy of justice is, quite frankly. And I think we need to better understand that, because we have a court that right now engages in a lot of Calvin ball, where they fit rulings to their personal ideological needs. We've had a court for the last several years, which particularly on corporate matters, which get a lot less attention, almost no attention in these hearings, that the court has become very strongly pro-business. And I feel like that is what gets missed in these various moments of grandstanding.
So I want to ask you, David, I mean, we're talking about judicial philosophy. This is a phrase that we heard repeatedly throughout the week, mostly from the Republican members of the court asking Judge Jackson, well, what is your judicial philosophy? Who is it modeled after? What other justice most closely resembles your own in terms of yourself, in terms of judicial philosophy? We know when Republican nominees are asked that question, they usually say someone like Antonin Scalia, who is seen as the conservative's conservative on the court. Generally speaking, Democratic nominees don't respond in that way. They don't say, oh, I'm in the mold of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, or I'm in the mold of a Justice Brennan, or anybody. They usually say what Justice Jackson said, which is, I'm about doing the work. I'm in my own mold. I approach the rulings that I make based on the law and my interpretation and the facts and the issues before me. So are you really surprised at the way she answered that question?
No, I'm not surprised, but I think it points to a sort of greater failing about Democratic conception of the law. I mean, Republicans have a very defined sense of what they want out of their leaders from a legal standpoint. They have honed that over many, many years, and they have a very sharp understanding, and they debate these things in public, not just in the Federalist Society and other forms of other forums, but very, very much publicly as part of their overall package to voters and to elites. And I don't really know what it is on the Democratic side. I mean, the interesting moment for me was when Senator Klobuchar started asking Judge Jackson about antitrust and particularly about cases that have been decided in such a way to make it very hard to unwind mergers and to engage in policies that promote competition. And Judge Jackson's response to that was that, the courts aren't policymakers, judges shouldn't be importing their policy preferences, and the kind of the usual cant that you hear in these hearings, which is designed to give no information about these the individual legal kind of philosophies for fear that it will lock them into some future ruling. The entire process has been designed to generate as little information as possible about the actual job that they're going to be doing. And I think we need more information there. I mean, I think we need more information about where justices stand on the concentration of the economy over the last 40 years. I think we need more information on a whole series of concepts around labor law and the laws of regulation and things of that nature.
Yeah, I mean, Sarah, I want to ask you, I'm not sure I agree with that. I'm not sure. I mean, we discussed before about how the confirmation process has changed so much, really, since the at least since the nomination of Robert Bork to the court, where now justices are very circumspect about anything that could give a hint, as David said, about how a justice might rule. But I think Judge Jackson, at the very least, demonstrated a really strong grasp and understanding of a vast array of areas of law, from antitrust. It's clear that she's read the Sherman Act, to patent law, to criminal law, to, Marbury v. Madison. I mean, she was asked about a lot of substantive things, and she seemed to display a really broad and strong knowledge of that, while not giving any hint on how she would rule before a case that might come to the court. Isn't that exactly what she was supposed to do, Sarah?
So actually, I think I'm going to take the middle ground here and say I agree with part of what you said and part of what David said, which is, yes, she clearly showed a mastery of all sorts of different types of law, as well she should, by the way, not only because of her academic pedigree and her job as a public defender, which I hope we'll get more into in a little bit, because I thought that was some of the most interesting part of the hearing for me. But also, she's been a district judge. She's been a circuit judge for a short amount of time. But still, that as a judge, you have to be the master of all. And so I wasn't surprised. But to David's point, these hearings have become so pointless in some sense that, you know, we're reading like not tea leaves, we're reading like microscopic mite leaves in floating in water, and then saying like, aha, we can discern this and this and this. No, you can't. You have no idea. And incentives matter, right? And so when you have hearings since Bork that have perpetually whomped on people forever coming anywhere close to answering a question. Really, you know, Bork maybe set the stage for not answering questions, but it was at that point, soon to be Justice Ginsburg's answer, where she created the non-answer, you know, this could come before me as a justice, so I'm not going to answer it. I don't know why we're still doing them, because clearly the only people benefiting are senators with political ambitions. We're not learning much about the potential justice. We're certainly not going to have them, qualified or disqualified based on what they say at the hearing. I don't know if David agrees with this, but I'd be for chucking the hearing at this point.
Well, what would people like us talk about then?
Self-interest always prevails.
Yes. But I mean, I think that there is a conservative argument that you want to break out of this paradigm that you're talking about, Sarah, because I think that you look at the rulings in the first year of Justice Barrett, and you look at the first couple years of rulings of Justice Kavanaugh, and this assumption, although it's not always true, but that the court has moved into kind of a 3-3-3 camp, where Justice Roberts, Barrett, and Kavanaugh are in sort of the middle ground, and the other three conservative justices are much further on the right end of the spectrum. I mean, that is potentially a function of the fact that we didn't really learn anything about these justices, Kavanaugh and Barrett, in their hearings, because of the precedent, as you correctly state, set by Justice Ginsburg to parry any questions about anything that might someday in some minor way come before the court.
Well, I would say, David, that we knew something about them just by way of the fact that they were selected by the Federal Society, and we knew that they had very strong conservative credentials in that sense going in. So I think that's a little bit different than here. Sarah, I want to get back to something that you mentioned, is the fact that Judge Jackson is a former public defender. It'll be the first time a federal public defender has ever been on the court, the first time any sort of public defender since Thurgood Marshall. Talk a little bit about what that meant to you, what you learned based on that, not necessarily the political framing of the questions, but on that substantively.
No, exactly. So I was in law school shortly after 9/11, and I remember in my ethics class, the professor asking who here would represent someone at Guantanamo Bay. And I was stunned I was president of the Harvard Federalist Society, right? This is at Harvard Law School, one of the most liberal law schools in America. And I was the only person who raised my hand. And I was so heartened by soon-to-be Justice Jackson's answers to her questions about how could she defend someone who is at Guantanamo Bay? Doesn't she think that someone who attacks the United States should rot in prison forever? And her answer was so perfect. You know, she is against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the United States. But what would be even more dangerous is not protecting our constitutional rights when faced with a crisis. Yeah. And what a great statement of the purpose of public defenders. And it goes all the way back to John Adams, of course, defending a British soldier in the Boston Massacre. This is the highest ideal of a lawyer, an officer of the court. And so for anything else, you know, I may not agree with a lot of what Justice Jackson may write when she gets to the Supreme Court, but I loved that statement about the role of a public defender.
I'm going to pause you right there so we can take a break. I will say that I would not have raised my hand. I knew in law school I did not have the stones to be a defender of any sort. So my hat goes off to both you and Judge Jackson. I'll be right back with Sarah Isger and David Dayan to talk about what we learned from these hearings about politics going into the midterms. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, columnist for the Boston Globe. On the right is Sarah Isger of The Dispatch, and on the left is David Dayan at The American Prospect. Confirmation hearings are always political, and these were supercharged. Americans heard Judge Jackson asked a lot about the kinds of social issues that appear to be animating conservative voters. And what were the most telling moments for you? I will start again here. I thought going into this, at first there was an early signal by some Republicans that they may question her qualifications, which I thought, all right, that's going to be a mistake. But they seemed to drop that pretty quickly. Then I thought, all right, maybe they see that attacking someone who is clearly qualified, who is thrice confirmed by the Senate for various positions, and who will be a historic addition to the court is a bad look. And so they won't attack. And I was actually shocked at the level of attack and the amount of the attack that she faced, particularly about how she did her job as a trial judge in cases involving child pornography. For me, Sarah, this didn't seem to be about the way she did her job at all, given that her sentences were largely in line with other federal judges, including those that were Republican appointed. This was trying to hit at an issue that really revolves around a small segment of the Republican electorate that seems to believe in conspiracy theories. What did you think about that particular line of questioning?
Kimberly, you and I both have legal podcasts separately from this.
Yes.
And in mine, I tried to find what I thought in advance of the hearings would be sort of the most controversial case that she had decided. It was an immigration case. It did get raised very briefly by Lindsey Graham. I did not have child porn on my bingo card. And as you said, look, child pornography sentencing and prosecutions in this country, I think, are something that we should have a conversation about. As I said earlier, Congress could set mandatory minimums. The sentencing guidelines are not mandatory. Judges can move above or below them. And so to say that she sentenced below the guidelines, of course, is a bit misleading, because you have to know she also got three sentencing recommendations from the prosecution, from the defense, and then from the probation office. And she got a pre-sentence report. And so you also want to ask, how are other judges sentencing? Are they sentencing below the guidelines? The answer is yes, quite often. And lastly, what is our purpose behind child pornography incarceration? Is it punishment? Is it deterrence? Or is it protecting society? All of those would have been fascinating conversations. And again, very legal, philosophical conversations But those weren't the conversations here. This was a conversation that just got sort of off on a tangent about a single specific case that she sentenced as a district judge. And as a conservative, I have to say, first of all, like I said before about hearings, incentives matter. If you set the incentive for district judges that they have to always give the maximum sentence allowed under the law, because if one of their criminal defendants that appears before them ever reoffends, they then aren't eligible to, you know, ever get a promotion to a higher court or to the Supreme Court. I don't think we want to live in that society. And I just felt like politically, it was a strange position for the Republicans, as opposed to what I'm sure we'll talk about later, the definition of a woman, the CRT conversations. Now, those don't matter for Judge Jackson, but if you want to score points on TV, they make sense. The child pornography thing made no sense to me.
So, David, I want to ask you, look, when it comes to how a judge does his or her job, that is an important determination when being nominated to a higher court. Asking her, I believe, about how she came to her decisions, including her decisions about what sentence to impose, I think is absolutely not just fair game, but that's essential. How do you draw the line between that and giving red meat to the kinds of folks who are like the guy who walked into a pizzeria here in Washington, D.C. a couple years ago and opened fire thinking that, you know, Hillary Clinton was hiding child victims in there?
I mean, I don't think the handful of Senate Republicans engaging in this line of questioning were drawing a line. They were obliterating a line. They were clearly just running a series of sound bites that wouldn't look out of place in the litany of commercials that Virginians saw in last year's elections. I mean, this was a purely political tactic, and a preview of the midterm strategy to talk about these very critical hot button issues. I mean, yeah, you're probably going to get a little bit of inflation sprinkled in there, but this is the way in which Republicans think they have the advantage on these culture war issues and also on crime. And that's how they're going to work it. I do want to thank Lindsey Graham for mentioning my publication, The American Prospect, during the hearings, because he was upset with reporting we did about his favorite candidate for this particular position, Michelle Childs. And I think it shows you, and he tried to weave this interesting kind of thing where there might have been connections between us and Judge Jackson, which I can unequivocally say there aren't. But in doing that, he talked about Arabella Advisors, which is a group that funnels donations to various nonprofits and tried to sort of make these connections around money and ideology in ways that were really very much in the line of what you would do if you were trying to disqualify a political candidate,
right?
Disqualify a judge.
Dark money. It made it seem very scary. Dark money is being funneled into this and it's behind her. Meanwhile, there is a ton of money that is spent on any judicial nominee, millions and millions of dollars by both conservative and liberal organizations to further this sort of, to push one way or another for the confirmation of judges. So that part isn't new. But David, I want to get back to a point that Sarah made about some of these other issues, things like critical race theory. You know, we saw the GOP ad that basically crossed out KBJ and wrote CRT. We heard Senator Cruz, who went to law school with Judge Jackson and was on Law Review with her, has known her for in excess of 20 years, asking her if he could be an Asian man, really getting to this idea of what is a woman, pushing to the issue of laws that affect transgender individuals and LGBTQ folks. What did you think about that approach? Is that something that could backfire on Republicans?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, they certainly don't seem to think so. What we've seen in the states in terms of legislation, whether the bill in Florida or the bill in Texas around transgender rights and literally going into homes of parents who engaged in some therapeutic interventions with their children, they seem to think that they have an advantage here. It's a very hot button issue. I am a little bit comforted by the fact that this week, two Republican governors vetoed bills around transgender athletes in sports, and in particular, the one from the governor of Utah, Spencer Cox, talks about the fact that there are literally four athletes who are transgender in his entire state, and the legislature decided to make a bill based on those four people, only one of which participates in women's sports. And just the smallness of this and the pulling out individual people and trying to cite them in this way and inflame tensions around it, it's really distasteful. And I just saw the line of questioning here as an extension of that. And you know, I mean, we'll see. We'll see if it's an effective tactic. Republicans certainly seem to think so.
And Sarah, I wonder if you worry that this could go too far in backlash. I know it's a Republican value to say, you know, there are things that should be left up to states, whether it's abortion laws or other laws governing how LGBTQ folks are treated, about other things. And could that lead down a slippery slope? I mean, the senator from Indiana, who in an interview seemed to intimate that it would be fine if Loving versus Virginia were overturned and laws governing interracial marriage be left up to the states. I made a joke that, oh, okay, I guess that means if I cross state lines, I could suddenly find myself single if it's up to states to write different laws as to whether people of different races can be married. But is it this something that could be really dangerous and be perilous for Republicans?
So a few things. One, I watched that clip of the interview and was befuddled. I mean, first of all, he was trying to make a point about how he was intellectually consistent, and that if you thought that, you know, abortion needed to be left up to the states, that therefore you would have to agree that interracial marriage would need to be left up to the states. But of course, race is very much mentioned in the Constitution in the 14th Amendment in a way that abortion is not. He walked it back a few hours later with something to that effect. It was a bizarre moment, frankly, of someone who thought they'd gotten the upper hand, and you can like see on his face and he's like, aha, I win this. And it's like, no, not really. So when it comes to Supreme Court nominations, Republicans have generally had the upper hand politically. Their voters are more likely to vote on or about the Supreme Court than Democratic voters. And so a little bit of, I think, what you're seeing at this hearing is a reflection of that reality. Democrats have for a long time tried to get their voters revved up about the court, and time and again, it hasn't worked. In 2018, the Missouri Senate election, Republicans are widely credited for winning that because of the way Kavanaugh was treated in his hearing. Again, not that Democrats didn't support what happened, but they don't vote on it, again, the way that Republicans do. So I think there's that aspect. Republican voters wanted to see senators doing everything they could, standing athwart, yelling, stop. I think it's interesting that Andrew McCarthy at National Review actually pushed back on Josh Hawley's questioning around the child porn sentences. Plenty of Trump judges wouldn't pass Josh Hawley's test. So there has been actually pushback within the movement. And then on the culture issues, I think Republicans are winning those right now. I think that the sort of erasure of women, which can be scoffed at on the one hand, is very intensely felt by a lot of women in this country. This idea that my experience, you know, getting my period at a slumber party in eighth grade or whatever, doesn't matter to being a woman, and that it's simply, someone can compete against me who went through male puberty and has male bone mass. Testosterone levels don't cover that. And I don't know that we've come up with a good answer as a society to what to do about that, but it can be very frustrating as a woman when we haven't reached equality in so many ways for the conversation to simply move on from women's equality and feminism and instead to this other conversation, which just doesn't acknowledge us.
David, I want to move a little bit to the issue about how the hearings themselves were handled. Dahlia Lithwick in Slate described what she called, quote, a pervasive sense of Democratic senators' almost chilling unwillingness to go to the mat for their nominee. She said that was with the exception of Cory Booker, basically saying that the Democrats did not protect Judge Jackson in the same way that Republicans protected now Justices Kavanaugh and Barrett. I don't know how I feel about that. I think that Judge Jackson is perfectly capable of protecting herself, that the chairman of the Senate Judiciary should not have among his or her jobs that being of referee or bodyguard. But what do you think about that?
Is perfectly capable and is perfectly capable and was perfectly capable. I mean, I think she acquitted herself pretty well, at least in what I saw. I don't know that Democrats really have a game plan on this. I mean, what Sarah said is true, that Democrats have tried at some level to rev up the base about various issues regarding the court, and it has met somewhat muted response. I think there's activist energy about doing something to change the dynamic on the court itself, whether that's adding justices or things like that. You've seen that bubble up sort of from the grassroots, and there are more organizations now on the left that actually try to substantively talk about these legal issues. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's filtered up to the Senate Judiciary Committee, which just seems to, you know, meander along and sort of ask random questions in these hearings without any kind of sort of stated philosophy. But I agree with you. I don't think they need to be bodyguards.
Yeah.
But I don't know what they'd want to be.
Yeah. You know, I thought at the end of all of this, it would spur a new conversation about the court, perhaps ways that it could be reformed or ways that the nominating process could be. I think what we saw was a preview of the substance of 2020, which is going to be about the culture wars. That's what voters should be ready for. I've been talking with David Dayan and Sarah Isger. We'll be right back with the Russian nuclear threat. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts. We want your feedback. Consider leaving a review at Apple Podcasts. And thanks.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Kimberly Atkins-Store, columnist at the Boston Globe. Those of us glued to the Senate confirmation hearings were often watching on a split screen with scenes of Russia's brutal invasion of Ukraine. We're now in the second month of the war. President Biden traveled to Europe to meet with NATO allies. NATO forces have expanded in Eastern Europe. And while Ukraine has been able to hold off Russian forces more successfully than expected, the fact that Russia holds nuclear weapons has the world on edge. Russian President Vladimir Putin's chief spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, this week refused to rule out using nuclear weapons against anything they consider to be an existential threat. We are joined now to discuss nuclear weapons and the threat that they pose with our special guest, Uri Friedman. He is the managing editor at the Atlantic Council and a contributing writer at the Atlantic. Hi, Uri.
Hi, good to be with you.
So you had an article in The Atlantic this week where you describe what a lot of people fear most about this conflict, that it will lead us to, quote, World War III, this time with multiple nuclear armed states. That's the nightmare scenario haunting many people as Russia's horrific war on Ukraine metastasizes, moving toward NATO's borders, stoking further Western involvement, sucking in other powers, and spurring nuclear threats. How real is that scenario? Describe how things, where they are now, could unravel to that point.
I think it's still a low probability scenario, but the risks are rising. And with something as serious, as grave, as big an effect for the world as the potential for nuclear war, you have to take seriously the fact that the risks are rising. In moments like this, you know, things can get very scary. The situation is very dangerous. And I often find it helpful to ground my understanding of contemporary challenges in some historical perspective. And so I was grappling with the same question you asked me, and I decided to reach out to several Cold War historians to ask them what they made of this moment. Is this moment, in their estimation, as dangerous as the most dangerous moments of the Cold War? You know, you often hear these days a lot of comparisons, for example, to the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was really synonymous in many of our views with the closest the world ever came to nuclear war. And I will say, and I'm happy to go into, you know, more detail on their responses, I spoke to 6 Cold War historians. 4 told me that they thought this moment was less dangerous than the Cuban Missile Crisis and other very acute showdowns, such as in 1983. But one said it was equally dangerous, just in different ways. And one said it was more dangerous. And I will say the biggest takeaway I had from it was that even if we set aside whether Vladimir Putin intends to use nuclear weapons, there is a huge risk of miscalculation or misperceptions, mistakes. That was the most serious risk in the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, John Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev did not want nuclear war, and yet they came right to the brink of it. And we are now double the time of what the Cuban Missile Crisis was. Cuban Missile Crisis lasted for 13 days. We are now a month into this crisis. And the longer it goes, and there's, by the way, no end in sight at the moment, the bigger chances you have of miscalculations or mistakes. And I think that is something we really need to be watching out for.
Let's talk a little bit about the reasons that the historians you talked to gave. I'm heartened that 4 of them think that this is a less dangerous moment and only one thinks more, but sort of take us on that range of reasons why. Why did the one say that this is more dangerous compared to the 4 who say that it is less? I think at the end of the day, it's hard to understand, at least to me, exactly what Vladimir Putin wants, but I have to believe that he knows that nuclear war is not a good outcome, the same as both Khrushchev and Kennedy knew that that was a bad outcome back then. So what's different now?
Yeah, I mean, he would know that there would be some kind of form of retaliation. I will say one thing that a lot of people are keeping an eye on is Russia has a military doctrine that they call escalate to de-escalate. And they've practiced this in military exercises. The idea is that they are willing to potentially escalate with nuclear weapons in order to get their opponents to back down. And so the concern right now is, one, obviously, as I mentioned, a mistake or miscalculation, but 2, that Vladimir Putin might use Russia's store of what's called tactical nuclear weapons, which are short range, relatively smaller scale. Nothing is small scale when you talk about nuclear weapons, but they might use something like that in either a demonstration or in some form on the battlefield in order to get enemies to back down. So that is something we're watching closely. And that ties in with what the one historian who thought things were more dangerous told me. And that is, I spoke to Vladislav Zubak, who is an historian at the London School of Economics. And I will say it was a very, very sobering, kind of dark conversation, because he said there are 2 reasons in particular why he thinks this is a more dangerous moment. One is that Vladimir Putin is less constrained politically than many of his Soviet predecessors. So Khrushchev, you know, all the Soviet premiers had the Politburo to deal with. They had a kind of collective decision-making apparatus. And right now in Russia, you know, Putin has completely centralized power. I did another article looking into, could Putin launch nuclear weapons on his own? And the consensus was that even though the Russian system has some checks in place with the defense minister and the chief of the general staff, really because of how much Putin has centralized power, he probably could just replace those people and order a nuclear launch on his own. So that's one reason. And the second reason is because Russia is actually a lot weaker today than the Soviet Union was during many of these crises that are so familiar to us during the Cold War. Then there was more parity on very various different levels between the two superpowers. Today, Russia, as we're seeing right now with its big losses, surprising losses on the battlefield, with its conventional forces in Ukraine, and also with its economic vulnerability to US and European sanctions, Russia is not a great power or superpower in the same way. But Zubak pointed out to me that the one domain in which they remain a superpower is nuclear weapons. And so his concern is that if Vladimir Putin is cornered, if he feels existentially threatened in some form, that he could try to use nuclear weapons in some way as kind of a joker card to change the game. Again, you know, we're in the fog of war right now. It's hard to know exactly what's in Putin's mind, but that was his concern.
And just one more quick question for you before I bring the panel in. How much does the fact that Russia seems to not be doing as well as maybe they expected to be doing? We're a month into this. I think they thought this operation would probably last a matter of days. How does that play into this equation?
I think it does play in a few different ways. One, you know, if Russia had had quick success, they may not have been thinking about how do we, you know, escalate this situation to win. I think, you know, Zubak's concern and others is that if they feel they can't win in any other forms of power short of nuclear weapons or other forms of weapons of mass destruction, such as biological or chemical weapons, that they may feel they need to resort to this. Secondly, I think there's a lot of people who are feeling encouraged by Ukraine's ability to resist this completely unprovoked Russian attack. But if Russia does not achieve its aims, but is also not able to be thrown out of the country, there is a concern that this will just settle into either a frozen conflict or a kind of grinding conflict. In that kind of situation, one, Putin might be tempted to use weapons over time and things might just escalate over time. But then two, as I mentioned before, you know, the longer this goes on, the more chances there are of miscalculation. It's hard to be perfect for any of these actors who are involved to act and behave perfectly, to understand with total clarity what its opponents are thinking. And Russia's stalemate could provide fertile ground for an escalation that is unintended.
Yeah, I want to bring our left, right, and center panel to join this discussion. On the right is Sarah Isger, and on the left is David Dan. David, to you first, quickly. Certainly, President Biden has to think not only what is right for NATO and the allies, he has to be thinking about what the American people are thinking. What do you think, as President Zelensky continues to push for more from NATO and his allies, what is Biden's next move right now?
Well, if you can't hear me very well, I'm under the desk right now after this discussion.
Sorry about that, David.
And I think that the nature of this discussion, it really reinforces the fact that we have to use every diplomatic tool available to try to end this war, and that the dangers of giving in to a very emotional decision to escalate in some way, whether that's through enforcement of a no-fly zone or the continued shipment of weapons, it's just an incredibly dangerous scenario, and we need to, and I think the Biden administration recognizes that, frankly. Although I would like to see them engage more on the diplomatic front, but they've sort of been leading from behind there. So I just think this underscores how fraught this moment is, and that as satisfying as it might be to cheer on Ukrainians and to believe, as you know, it is reasonable to do, that their need for more protection is incredibly important. We need to keep in the back of our minds how this can spiral out of control.
Sarah, just a couple minutes. What are your thoughts?
I agree with everything David said, but there's a flip side to it as well, which is, if we don't contain this in Ukraine and we look back in 2 years and Russia did use nuclear weapons anyway, and use them potentially against other NATO allies so that we're drawn into a nuclear engagement regardless, then we'll regret not doing more in Ukraine. And that's where I think the tension really lies, is that everything David said is true, but not doing those things comes with its own risk as well. You know, you think back to post-World War One and the punishing, let's call them sanctions now, put on Germany pretty clearly led to the rise of Hitler. There are always unintended consequences. And Chamberlain's actions in the run-up to World War II seemed, I think, if you were there at the time, like a pretty reasonable response, unless you knew what was coming next. And then it wasn't reasonable as we look back with hindsight. That's where I think the really hard part comes. And then to all of that, you add in nuclear weapons.
Uri, what do the political calculations that President Biden also has to have in his mind play into what you wrote about in the nuclear threat?
Well, I think, very briefly, I think President Biden does know there. Well, I think there's actually been a swell of support for Ukrainian resistance among the American public. But that said, he knows certainly from his experience in Afghanistan that there's very little appetite for direct military interventions. And so I think he's trying to strike that balance. You know, they've made a declaratory policy that they are not going to directly engage with Russia. That is the current policy. If something changes in the conflict, that could change as well. But I think that is calculated to both provide support but not get so involved that they get sucked into the conflict. And as President Biden has said, to avoid World War III. So that is the current stance. I think he is trying to be where the American public is largely, actually. But the question is, can it hold over a long-term conflict?
Uri Friedman, managing editor at the Atlantic Council and a contributing writer at the Atlantic. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. David Dayan, it's your soapbox.
Well, here in California, Democrats are considering giving $400 to people struggling with gas prices that are close to $6 a gallon here, the highest in the nation. I've heard some argue that this will just cause more inflation, but they need to explain how a $9 billion program in a $3 trillion economy would actually do that. At the individual level, this is just an inflation shock absorber, a small measure to help deal with price rises, and other countries like France have done this for their citizens, but usually they target the support to the people most in need. Governor Gavin Newsom's idea to give the rebate to all car owners isn't really good targeting. A better option would be to replace what Congress took away at the beginning of this year. In January, monthly child tax credit payments ended for Americans with children, a measure that was reducing child poverty by close to half. The $9 billion California wants to use on this rebate would restore enhanced CTC funding in the state for about a year, creating a national model for supporting families. And in my view, anytime you have the opportunity to be the anti-Joe Manchin, you should take it. So let's go, California.
All right, Sarah Isger, what's your rant?
So for those listeners who've been tuning in for the last couple of weeks, I sound a little different. And that's because this week I have COVID and not the fun asymptomatic COVID that it feels like all of my friends got for the last 2 years. I have full-on COVID and I am triple vaxxed. And what I am going to rant about today is how grateful I am for these vaccines, not because we know that I would be less sick or rather more sick if I hadn't gotten the vaccines, but because as my fever spiked, as I got chills, as I couldn't sleep and the congestion and the cough, I felt safe knowing that the likelihood that I would be hospitalized or potentially even die was so, so infinitesimally low because of the miracle of these vaccines. It's not just about whether you're going to get sick. Look at me, I'm pretty sick. But it's about knowing that I wasn't about to leave my toddler son behind as I was sitting there deeply uncomfortable, clutching my tissue box and cough drops.
Well, I wish you a speedy recovery, Sarah. And for my rant, it is fitting that Judge Jackson was nominated to be the first Black woman on the Supreme Court in February, Black History Month, and that her confirmation hearing was in March, Women's History Month. Or is it fitting? You know, as time goes by, I appreciate the importance of why we have those months in the first place. It is important to recognize everyone's crucial role in history, including women, including Black folks, including all the people who have helped make this country great. But I've come to think about it now as like a Valentine's Day card. Yeah, it's nice, but I really would like my husband to appreciate me and be romantic all year long. And I think that's what we have to do now as a nation, find a way to integrate the experiences and the contributions of everyone all year long. I'm afraid that just focusing 1 month on what women did and 1 month, by the way, the shortest month of the year, on what Black Americans have done, kind of lets people off the hook for the rest of the year. And it also marginalizes and boxes in what we've done. I like to think that for myself, I make history every single day. And I think for others to appreciate and understand the history that folks like me are making, we need to stop putting ourselves in boxes.
Hear, hear, Kimberly.
Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks to Sarah Isger, David Dayan, and Uri Friedman. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Laura Dine Million. Our production assistant is Nisha Venkat. The show is recorded and mixed by Desmond Taylor. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.